WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. In the past 20 years, the field of volcano science has progressed at warp speed, in part because of one catastrophic event, the eruption of Mount St. Helens in May of 1980. Starting in the mid-70s, my guest, volcanologist Dan Miller, was part of a team of scientists from the U.S. Geological Survey studying Mount St. Helens. The geological data told them that Mount St. Helens had erupted every 100 years for the last four millennia, a pattern which meant that by the late 1970s, the volcano was overdue. The team also predicted that the eruption had the potential to be catastrophic. Magma or molten rock beneath the surface of the mountain was building up. They warned that Mount St. Helens could spew tons of deadly ash and also produce mud flows, which could bury hundreds of miles of roads, homes, and wildlife on the mountain. The question was when. Dan Miller is a resident geologist for the U.S. Geological Survey. He heads their Volcano Disaster Assistance Program and was one of the members of the survey's response team at Mount St. Helens when it went. He and his colleagues are profiled in a new book, Volcano Cowboys, by journalist Dick Thompson. I asked Dan Miller what was happening on the mountain in the weeks before it blew.
Well, we knew something serious was coming because there were literally thousands of earthquakes per day occurring at Mount St. Helens, and they started on March 20th, and they marched on a steady series of very large events. I mean, every day there were as many as 8 or 10 magnitude 4 earthquakes, and there were literally hundreds of earthquakes that were smaller than that. So we knew something serious was happening. We knew that magma was moving up into the volcano. We could detect that by the changes in the shape of the volcano. There was a very prominent bulge that developed on the north side of the volcano and began moving steadily forward at 4 or 5 feet per day. So we knew the volcano was becoming progressively more unstable. By the time early May rolled around, we fully expected some kind of a major collapse of the north flank of the volcano. And we expected that that would be followed by an explosive eruption. Mainly, we envisioned a vertical eruption. And so we were a little bit surprised or taken aback by the magnitude of the lateral explosion that occurred on the morning of May 18.
Where were you when Mount St. Helens went? And what did you see?
Well, I was driving up Interstate 5. I was about 5 miles north of Vancouver, up on a flat part of the road where I had a good view of Mount St. Helens. And I was actually headed up to the north side to our Coldwater 2 observation post. And I had fresh batteries for some time-lapse cameras up there and a few parts to fix one of our cameras. And I had intended to spend the day up there working on those cameras and observing the volcano. At 8:32, as I was driving up I-5, I looked off to the northeast, and there was this gigantic mushroom cloud rising above the mountain. And as I watched, it accelerated and climbed to maybe 40 or 50,000 feet and was still climbing. And at that point, I recognized that this was a much larger eruption than any of the small steam eruptions that we had seen prior to this morning, and that it was a major magmatic eruption. And so I turned around quickly and got onto the southbound part of the freeway and raced back to Vancouver. I ran up into the office that we shared with the U.S. Forest Service there, and that was sort of the beginning of the busiest day of my life.
You had a colleague posted at one of your observation posts. Did you know immediately from what you had seen that he might be in danger?
Immediately, I didn't know. You're referring to my good friend and colleague, David Johnston, and he was at Coldwater 2 at the observation post that I was headed for that morning. And when I saw the big eruption, I thought, wow, you know, that's neat. He's going to have a good view of it, and he's up there and can take notes and see what's happening. When I rushed back into the office in Vancouver, the first thing that I did was ran over to our radio transmitter, and I radioed Dave to see what was happening. And I didn't receive an answer from Dave, and not only that, I didn't even receive an answer from the repeater that we had located on a mountaintop that was quite a ways further away from the volcano than Dave Johnston was. And at that point, I had a sickening feeling, a realization that the eruption was a huge eruption and that something really devastating had happened that had destroyed our radio repeater at a distance of about, I guess it was about 8 miles due north of the volcano. And I had a bad feeling that something terrible had probably happened to Dave at that point.
Dave Johnson did die in the eruption. Well, what happened to him?
Well, he was located on a ridgetop about 5 miles due north of Mount St. Helens. When the eruption began, the north flank of the volcano broke loose. It had become very unstable due to the bulging that occurred toward the north. As it broke loose, the whole north flank slid down into the valley of the North Fork of the Toutle River. And it essentially depressurized. It was sort of like popping the cork on a bottle of champagne. Inside the volcano was a pressurized body of magma or partially molten rock. And when the landslide depressurized it, it blew up. And it blew up very violently. It produced this cloud, a very turbulent cloud of rocks and ash and hot gases that expanded very rapidly to the north. By the time it reached the ridge that Dave was on, it was moving at several hundred miles an hour, and there were hot rocks as large as 3 or 4 feet across that were flying through the air at 300 or 400 miles an hour. So Dave and the car that he had and the trailer house that we had parked up there were hit by this cloud, this blast cloud, which, by the way, continued to accelerate. It reached speeds of perhaps 700 miles an hour. It spread out to completely destroy an area of 230 square miles in the course of about 3 or 4 minutes from the onset of the eruption. So Dave was presumably killed by this expanding blast cloud.
Who were the people besides your colleague and some other scientists? Who were the people who died in the blast? Were there tourists still on the mountain?
Yes, there were many people, campers, hikers, and people interested in seeing the volcano and in filming it and photographing it and watching what was happening. There were hazard zones, closed zones, a so-called blue zone and a red zone that were established around the mountain to keep people out except for scientists and law enforcement people. Those zones didn't always coincide with the hazard zones that we as scientists felt were hazardous places to be. And there were loggers from logging companies working in and around the blast zone. And so we were very fortunate, actually, that the eruption occurred on a Sunday morning, because there would have been as many as 200 or 300 additional people killed if it had been on a weekday when the loggers would have been up there working. But I guess Dave Johnston was the only scientist that I'm aware of who was killed. And there was a photographer working for a local newspaper and for National Geographic by the name of Reed Blackburn. And he was at one of our observation posts, and he was killed. And to the best of my knowledge, the rest of the people who were killed were tourists or loggers or sightseers who were up there, many of them looking at the volcano.
You and your other colleagues later, when it was safe, flew over the part of the mountain that was devastated in the eruption. What did it look like, and what did it smell like?
Well, it was the strangest thing that I've ever seen in my life, because I had worked at Mount St. Helens beginning in 1974, and I had been there for 2 months before May 18, and I had worked out there nearly every day. So I knew the north side of the volcano like the back of my hand, and I knew what Spirit Lake looked like. I knew what the forested hills and ridges to the north of the volcano looked like. I knew what our observation post looked like, because I had spent a lot of my time up there. On the morning after the eruption, when we flew in by helicopter to try to find Dave and find out what had happened to Dave, it was a brand new and really bizarre landscape that greeted us. I mean, the first time we landed on these hot new deposits, it was like landing on the moon. Here we were standing in an area 230 square miles in area without a living thing. There were no trees left. There were no animals left. There were no insects. There were no birds. There was no noise. The ground was hot. There was steam coming out of the ground from thousands and thousands of places. You had to watch where you walked to keep from sinking into these deposits that would have literally started your clothes on fire. So it was a very strange situation. I mean, in the twinkling of an eye, this incredible forested landscape with beautiful virgin trees that were 200 feet high were transformed into a dead wasteland, essentially, that literally did look like the moon. It was a gray color. There was no other color but gray. So my colleagues and I walked around in this environment and looked at what had happened, and I mean, it was hard to know where to begin. This was a totally new landscape.
My guest is volcanologist Dan Miller. He's a resident geologist for the United States Geological Survey, and he heads the survey's Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, which helps developing countries in the event of a volcanic eruption. Miller has studied volcanoes all over the world, and he was part of the USG Surveys team during the Mount St. Helens eruption. Dan, we're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is volcanologist Dan Miller. He heads the U.S. Geological Survey's Volcano Disaster Assistance Program and was part of the survey's team at Mount St. Helens when it erupted. After Mount St. Helens blew, new research into another West Coast volcano indicated that it too was showing signs of activity. The volcano was a tourist destination in the town of Mammoth Lakes in California. The survey issued a warning, which was met with hostility from the community.
At Mount St. Helens, as we've been talking, there were some very clear symptoms that the volcano was waking up before May 18. And these included swarms of earthquakes, deformation of the ground, and volcanic gases that were coming out of the ground. Well, in the early 1980s, we began to see the same kinds of things happening in the Mammoth Lakes area of central eastern California. And it really scared us because this is an area that has produced many volcanic eruptions in the past, including explosive ones on various scales, both very, very large and small to moderate. This was an area that seemed to be waking up just the way Mount St. Helens did. And so we very quickly completed a preliminary hazard assessment and published it because we wanted to get that information into the hands of public officials and into the hands of the public, which, by the way, in the region of Mammoth Lakes, there can be 30 or 40,000 people there on a ski weekend or on a busy summer weekend. Unfortunately, this notice of potential hazard that we issued caused all kinds of problems in the town of Mammoth Lakes and for the region in terms of panicking some of the real estate people. Their property values may have decreased some, and people were very angry. Instead of appreciating the fact that the U.S. Geological Survey was monitoring their volcanoes and assessing hazards for them and trying to warn them about the possibility of an eruption, many people reacted very negatively, and they were very mistrustful of us and our motives. And for a while, for a number of years there, I was sort of the point person for our agency, and it was my job to try to explain to the populace and to the public officials what the hazards were, why we were concerned about the possibility of eruption, and what the impacts might be. And yes, there were some negative reactions towards my information.
Did someone threaten your life?
Yeah. Somebody did come up to me one time in a restaurant, and a realtor, I guess, and told me that I should watch what I was talking about, and I should stop talking nonsense about hazards, volcanic hazards for Mammoth Lakes, and that if I didn't do so, somebody might put a bomb in my car, which I took as a serious threat, and it was actually pretty scary.
What are the North American hotspots now?
Well, Mammoth Lakes, California continues to be the most active place in the western United States in terms of the kinds of precursors that precede eruptions. There are about 10,000 earthquakes per year that are occurring in the Mammoth Lakes, California area. Many of these earthquakes occur inside a feature that's called a volcanic caldera. It's basically a gigantic volcano crater that the town of Mammoth Lakes is sitting inside of. And there also is evidence of continued bulging or deformation in the middle of the caldera. And there are areas now in the western part of the Long Valley caldera where forests have been killed by volcanic gases that have been coming out of the ground. So I think it's fair to say that there still is unrest occurring. It's been going on now for 20 years in the Mammoth Lakes area. And during that time, we've had two episodes when we think that magma actually moved upwards toward the surface, but fortunately it did not make it to the surface. So I think the most, one of the potential areas for volcanic activity is in the Long Valley Mono Craters area of Eastern California. Following that area, that Mount St. Helens is probably the most likely volcano to reawaken in the near future, because it's only been 14 years since the last magmatic eruption at Mount St. Helens, and it could awaken at any point and erupt again.
What about Mount Rainier?
Well, actually, Mount Rainier and the rest of the Cascade Range volcanoes are also candidates for eruptions. Mount Rainier has erupted not as frequently as Mount St. Helens, but still every few hundred years for the last several thousand years. It certainly will erupt again. It's a massive volcano with lots of snow and ice on it. And so any eruption worthy of the name is going to produce hot materials on the summit area that will cause melting of snow and ice, and that will cause huge lahars or mud flows to go down the flanks. So Mount Rainier is, to many of us, it's probably the most hazardous volcano in the United States because it has a great number of people at risk.
Are you confident now that you'll be able to get people out of a danger area before an eruption? Can you and your colleagues call it that closely and that precisely?
Well, no, I can't honestly say that I'm confident. First of all, you know, scientists have nothing to do with making evacuation decisions. And so even if we think a volcano is about to blow up and if we can provide an accurate warning or forecast, we're not involved in forcing people to leave. And so that's a decision that has to be made by somebody else, by public officials, by land use managers, and so forth. However, despite the fact that we've come an incredibly long ways in the last 20 years in terms of our ability to monitor volcanoes and to forecast their eruptions, there still are some issues that remain unresolved. And one of them is that volcanoes, when they start to erupt, they often erupt for months or even years. So we're not looking for one eruption that we try to forecast or one evacuation that public officials have to make. Sometimes there may be 10 or 15 or 20 major eruptions in an eruptive episode, and these might be dragged out over a period of several years. And we have trouble forecasting each of these eruptive episodes in terms of when they occur exactly and how large they will be. And the result is that there are still many uncertainties, and there's a lot that we need to do to continue to improve our ability to forecast individual explosive events in a socially useful context so that people can be evacuated for the event and then come back in after the event.
I would think there's a kind of difficult dichotomy involved in your job, and that the most exciting opportunity for a volcanologist is for a volcano to erupt and for you to be there and to see it and experience it. On the other hand, a lot of your job is working to mitigate the violence and the loss of life from the eruption. You're acutely aware of how dangerous it is and of the danger caused by an eruption. It must be hard to kind of temper your enthusiasm.
Well, you've sort of hit the nail on the head, Barbara. I have to confess that to a volcanologist, when we get to visit an erupting volcano and watch this incredible process take place, that it can be incredibly thrilling. It's exciting. The earth is alive and kicking, and an erupting volcano is one of the most spectacular events on earth, I think. And so on the one hand, we tend to be very excited. We're very enthusiastic. We're scientifically very interested, because each time we get to respond to a volcano crisis, we get to add some additional data to our database about how volcanoes work and what kinds of precursors precede eruptions, and how to mitigate volcanic hazards. So it is an exciting event for us. However, the downside is a terrible one, and that is that it is really tragic to see a volcano erupt, to see people evacuated from their homes, from their villages, from their livelihoods, from their animals and their gardens and so forth, and to see what that does to segments of society that are impacted by explosive volcanism. So there's no getting around it that unless a volcano is in a very remote place where it endangers no one, that's a perfect situation for scientists to study a volcano and to learn from it without having this downside. But in many places in the world now, volcanoes are densely populated. And so when they wake up, there are very serious impacts. And even if people are not killed, if they're evacuated in time, the evacuations themselves and what happens to people who are kept out of their homes for months or even years is a disaster of major proportions. So you're right, this is a complicated thing for a volcanologist to see and to be involved in, and it has its downside as well as its scientifically interesting side.
Dan Miller, well, thank you very much for talking with me today.
It's my pleasure.
Dan Miller heads the U.S. Geological Survey's Volcano Disaster Assistance Program, which monitors volcano activity in the U.S. and around the world. He's profiled in the new book Volcano Cowboys by journalist Dick Thompson. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.